The national parks may be one of America's best ideas, but environmental protection has come at a price. In Yellowstone, Yosemite, and other parks, government soldiers forcibly removed the native people who were living on this land. Journalist Mark Dowie says this is the untold story behind the national parks. In his book, Conservation Refugees, Dowie charts the conflict between environmentalists and native people around the world. And this isn't ancient history. He told Steve Paulson about an incident just a few years ago when a Maasai leader from Africa confronted thousands of environmentalists at an international conference in Bangkok.
Martin Sanengo, who is a Maasai leader, was standing up against the wall of a large plenary session. And he stood out because he was the only black person or person of color in the room at the time. The people there were talking about conservation strategies and everything. And when they were done, he raised his hand and said, "Your conservation paradigm has destroyed our culture, the Maasai culture." And he went in at some length about how the Maasai managed their landscape, mostly in the Rift Valley of Kenya and Tanzania. And he then said, "You have made us enemies of conservation." And the room just went totally silent. I mean, the idea that someone had come all the way from Kenya to tell 6,000 conservationists that they were creating enemies of conservation amongst people who'd been living off the land, stewards of that land for thousands of years, was really an earth-shaking event.
So why did this Maasai man say that conservation had turned his people into the enemy?
Because since the turn of the century, the 20th century, the large conservation organizations of the world, headquartered in Europe and the United States, had basically created a foothold in Kenya and Tanzania and had isolated the best land and the best watering areas of the Maasai Grays, which goes all the way up and down the Rift Valley, for wildlife, and mostly charismatic wildlife, the kind of wildlife that draws the attention of ecotourists and similar travelers. So
you're talking about the antelope and lions and elephants and those kinds of animals.
Giraffes, yes, precisely. So gradually, the Maasai began to lose their best grazing land and their best watering holes. As a consequence, their culture, which is a cattle culture, went into decline. And today, there are Maasai men working as security guards in Dar es Salaam and working in brothels in Dar es Salaam. This is hardly what their culture was all about.
So you're saying the untold story of a lot of conservation efforts around the world is that environmentalists come in, claim a piece of land as public land or as a national park, but in the process boot out the native people.
And of course, the national park is an American invention. So when romantics like Bunnell and John Muir and photographers like Weed were in there taking pictures and creating a sort of romantic image of Yosemite, and really an artificial image because they did not include the fact that there had been people living in Yosemite Valley for 4,000 years. And in fact, it became their intention to remove those people from Yosemite Valley.
This is a serious charge you're making in a way. I mean, John Muir, of course, is one of the great conservation heroes. And then the photographers who kind of turned Yosemite into a national icon, like Ansel Adams, you're saying they, in a sense, whitewashed the history to blot out the indigenous people who were actually living in Yosemite at that time.
Ansel Adams would wait for hours after he'd set up a camera on a scene that he liked. He would wait for hours until there were no humans in the setting, and then he would click the camera. There were, at the time, a lot of people living in that area. Some of them were nomadic. They were coming in just during a growing season, but they were there, and it was very much their hunting and growing ground. They cultivated it, not in a way that we would recognize because they didn't build fences or plow the ground, but they cultivated it and they burned it out periodically to enrich the soil and clear the underbrush. So it was a managed landscape. There's no question about it.
So what happened to these Native Americans once Yosemite was turned into a national park?
Well, in the early stages, there was militias, battalions that were under the orders of the first state government, Governor Peter Burnett, to kill them all. So a lot of them were routed out, killed. Some of them were put into reservations in the center of the state. But they were very wily. They knew how to sneak back in when the militias disappeared and resettle in different parts of the park. And they did. And ultimately, the park realized that there was no way they were going to get them out permanently. So they hired them, basically. They created an Indian village inside the park, and they put them to work as guards and maintenance people in the park. But they allowed them, through attrition, to reduce their population to zero. And in 1969, the last Awanishi left the park, and that was it. They were gone.
This is a really sad story.
It is. There were seven parks in the United States after Yosemite that followed the same example. And go fast forward to Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, which routed seven tribes out of that park. And in one day, they killed 300 Shoshone who were just intransigent and wouldn't move. So that was a very violent eviction. And there have been other violent evictions since. And there are seven parks in the U.S. that were cleared of Native people to create the park.
So you're saying this model of national parks that was created in the United States was then exported to other countries, and the same scenario played out of the sort of the government officials booted out the Native people?
Exactly. And in fact, it became known as the Yosemite model of conservation worldwide. And then later in Africa, it was renamed fortress conservation because people were kept out of their land, out of their habitat, and a sort of fortress policy.
Well, it seems to me that the root of this model is based on some pretty controversial ideas and some words like the word wilderness and even the word nature, which actually mean different things depending on who you're talking to. I guess the conventional idea of wilderness is that this is pristine land uninhabited by human beings. But you don't accept that definition, do you?
Well, I accept it because it's written into the law. The Wilderness Act of 1963 uses those very words, that wilderness is land that is untrammeled by man. But it's law based on a false premise. And the false premise is that this land was never occupied or cultivated by Native people. And in almost every case, it has and was.
You tell some kind of funny anecdotes about visits you've had with Native people, and you ask them what they think of this idea of wilderness, and they practically laugh about
it. Well, it's not in their language. The word wild, wildness, and wilderness is not in indigenous languages.
Because there was no concept of nature being separate from humans.
In one case, I described what I meant by wilderness, and the person I was talking to said, oh, you mean our pantry, right? And in another case, it took me a long time through an interpreter to explain what I meant by wildness and wilderness. And the woman I was interviewing started to laugh. And I said, what's so funny? And her interpreter says, well, the last time she saw what you're talking about was on a street corner outside a bus station in Winnipeg, Manitoba. So we have a concept of wildness and wilderness that is just alien to indigenous people around the world.
Okay, well, we've been talking about some of the history that goes back to the 19th century. Take the story up to the present. I mean, haven't concepts about wilderness and conservation changed since then to try to accommodate Native peoples?
Yes. I think this story is going to have a happy ending. I think that Western conservationists and Western biological scientists are beginning to realize, first of all, that the land that they're interested in preserving to preserve biological diversity is and has been occupied by good stewards for a long, long time. They're living in ways that we call sustainable.
Hmm. So if you had to pick one or two true success stories where the needs and the rights of local people have really been respected and they have become stewards of these parks or public lands, what would they be?
Well, the Matavan Forest in Colombia is an example I use in my book. These are people who have been good stewards of that area for a long, long time. They could see what was coming. The Bingos, the big international NGOs, were moving into the area. So they went to their government and said, look, don't cut us out of this process. Let us hunt and gather on this land, and we will keep it the way it is, the way we've kept it for thousands of years. We think we're the best at doing that. And the Colombian government and ultimately the big international NGOs agreed, and the Matavan Forest is an indigenous reserve.
Mark Dowie talked with Steve Paulson. Dowie's the author of Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples.